It's wonderful to be with you here tonight to look at this question, this subject, Jesus, man, myth, reality. And I want to begin with a question, and the question is this: what do people who know you say about you? How would someone who knew you really well describe you? Tonight we are going to be considering the person Jesus. If we were to do a survey here in Vienna at the university, asking people what they thought, what they think about Jesus, I'm sure that we would receive lots of replies. Some of them might be quite interesting. There might be a range of views about who Jesus is, who Jesus was. I'm sure some would be positive and others would be not very complimentary. So we're going to spend some time tonight examining this question of who Jesus really is. That can be a dangerous thing to do. It can be dangerous to ask people for an honest description. The story is told of a lawyer who was prosecuting his first trial in America, in the South, in a small town in the state of Mississippi. And the prosecuting lawyer, it was his first trial, he was rather nervous, and he called the first witness to the stand. She was an elderly, rather grandmotherly woman. And as he approached her, he thought, "I'll give you an easy question first." So he said, "Mrs. Jones, do you know me?" She responded, "Oh, yes, I do know you, Mr. Williams. I've known you since you were a boy, and frankly, you've been a big disappointment to me. You lie, you cheat on your wife, you manipulate people and you talk about them behind their backs. You think you are a big shot and you haven't the brains to realise you'll never amount to anything more than a two-bit paper pusher. Yes, I know you." The lawyer was stunned, and not knowing how to recover in front of the jury, he pointed across the courtroom and he said, "Do you know the lawyer for the defence?" She again replied, "Oh, yes, I do. I've known Mr. Bradley since he was a youngster. He's lazy, bigoted, and he has a drinking problem. He can't build a normal relationship with anyone, and his law practice is one of the worst in the entire state. Not to mention, he cheated on his wife with three different women, and one of them was your wife. Yes, I know him." The defense lawyer, Mr. Bradley, nearly died. At this point, the judge asked both lawyers to approach the bench, and in a very quiet voice he said, "If either of you idiots asks her if she knows me, I'll send you both to the electric chair." An honest description can be uncomfortable. It can be embarrassing. But at one moment in Mark's gospel, Jesus asks directly one of the disciples, first of all, who do the crowds out there say I am? What are people saying about me? Who do they think I am? And then he focuses the question in more personally, and he asks this question. He says, "Who do you say I am?" And tonight we're going to be considering our response to that question of Jesus. Who do you say Jesus is? Is he for you the distant figure in a stained glass window? Is he a religious teacher important in a bygone era of parents and grandparents? But what about you? Who do you say this Jesus is? Well, Peter, the disciple who's being asked this question, answers, "You're the Christ." That's a familiar word, but what does it mean? There's a claim being made here that the man who lived in history, Jesus, attested to by pagan and Roman, Jewish and Christian ancient sources, is the Christ. Peter has seen him feed 5,000, walk on water, heal a deaf man, raise a paralytic up to walk, and to claim to be able to forgive people's sins. Jesus is no ordinary man. The claim here that he is the Christ is that he is the long-expected anointed one, the one who was prophesied about in history, who was going to enter the world as the saviour of the world, the one who is going to be able to reconcile people in their relationship to God, the one through whom human beings could have access to God. But can we really believe that? Should we really believe that in the 21st century? Many people would say, you know, that's a nice story, but it's at the level of a fairy story or a fable or a myth. I recently had the privilege of taking a small group of visiting students to the documents library of one of the Oxford colleges where I work. And this college that we were visiting was called Magdalen College. And we were going to view three fragments of Matthew's Gospel, which have caused something of a stir fairly recently. Believed by most scholars to date between 150 and 200 AD, they are early fragments of copies of Matthew's Gospel that were found in Egypt in two centuries ago, in the last, sort of late 1800s. The existence of these fragments from copies of Matthew underscore the fact that the original Gospel of Matthew must have been completed no later than the mid-first century, in the lifetime of Matthew, the disciple of Jesus himself. This Gospel couldn't have been made up by much later scribes, layering mythology on top of history, since we have such early fragments. And that means that the miraculous and divine claims of Christ and about Christ are not later additions to the tradition. One scholar has even caused much more of a stir by claiming these fragments themselves are first century. This is highly contested, but it's an extraordinary possibility. If the Gospels were written in the first century, there isn't enough time for legend to have developed about Jesus, since the eyewitnesses of his life and his preaching were still alive to pick holes in such fabricated accounts. We know from studies of history that legends require time and space to develop. For example, the two earliest biographies of Alexander the Great were written by Arrian and Plutarch, and they're more than 400 years after Alexander's death. Yet classical historians consider them to be useful and trustworthy accounts. The fabulous legends about Alexander the Great don't develop until centuries after these two writers. According to one scholar, the writings of Herodotus enable us to determine the rate at which legend accumulates. And the tests show that even two generations is too short a time span to allow legendary tendencies to wipe out the hard core of the original historical facts. So when we look at the Gospels, the rate of legendary accumulation that would be necessary to believe that this is myth, that this is pure legend, would be unbelievable. Now, of course, many people do believe that the Gospels are religious, mythical, fantasy, fiction in intention. Some scholars have tried to make a distinction between the historical Jesus, the man Jesus who lived in history, and the Christ of people's faith, the object of people's devotion and worship, which would be seen by them as more of a kind of projection, if you like, onto the historical person. But the Gospels were not written as such. They claim to be based on eyewitness testimony. They claim to be historical. They claim to be truthful in what they're doing. And detailed archaeological studies find that the Gospel writers are good historians. Details of people, dates, places match other records. And it's precisely these kinds of details that give us an insight into how reliable the Gospels are, into what good historians they were. And one of the things I want to just talk about for a few moments tonight is an interesting piece of research that sheds some more light on this. And that's that the Gospel writers get not just historical details about shapes of houses and people who were ruling in power. They also get other more difficult to understand details right. And that namely is the names of people involved. Now that may sound like a simple thing, but it's surprisingly difficult to do. I don't know how often you've been to see a film at the cinema. You've been to see the film, you've watched it, and the plot was really gripping. You even know who some of the actors are, and you come back and you begin to discuss the film with your friend or whoever you went with your family. And it's really hard to remember the names of the characters involved. You're grasping, even from half an hour earlier, for the name. The plot, the story is easy to remember, but the detail, like someone's name, is hard to get right. Now, when we look at the Gospels, we know from tradition that the four Gospels were written far away from the land of the origin where the stories that they're reporting happened. For example, Mark's Gospel was written in Rome. Luke's Gospel was written in Antioch or possibly Achaia. John's Gospel was written in Ephesus, that's in Turkey. And Matthew's Gospel is most likely actually to have been written in Judea. So, how do these gospel writers, writing hundreds of miles away, far away geographically from the events that they're recording, how do they get the details right? I suggest to you that if you were writing a story or you were writing something about Austria even 100 years ago, you would struggle to get the names of people right, because these sorts of details change. Without extensive research, without knowledge, you would struggle to get those things right. Well, when we examine the time of Jesus, a study has been done of 3,000 names. It was done by a researcher in Germany. And she was looking into what people were called back then in Palestine from the Jewish community. And she took inscriptions and all the sources that were available archaeologically to document what the most popular names were, both male and female. A few years later, that was done in 2002, a few years later, a theologian, a theological scholar, picked up this study, looked at it, and correlated it with the Gospels to see if there was a tie-up between what people were actually called in Palestine in the first century and what the New Testament said people were called, just the characters in the books, in the Gospels. Taking Palestinian Jewish names in the first century, this is the order of popularity according to the academic study. First most popular name, Simon. Second, Joseph. Third, Lazarus. Fourth, Judas. Fifth, John. Sixth, Jesus. Seventh, Ananias. Eighth, Jonathan. Ninth, Matthew. Tenth, Menahem. And 11th, James. The correlation between what people were called in all the source material available for the ancient world about male Jewish names at that time, and what's actually recorded in the New Testament, the Gospels, and remember, they weren't written predominantly, three of the four Gospels were not written in the land of origin, they were written miles away. Yet, despite that, the correlation is astonishing. If you take the nine top Jewish Palestinian male names together, outside the New Testament, they're 41% of name usage. In the New Testament, they're 40%. This is a pattern that shows up over four writers writing five books, if you include the book of Acts, which was a follow-on from Luke. These Gospels reflect that pattern together and individually. The Gospel writers get the names right. along with early manuscript finds. So even just in the last 2 years, fragments of the New Testament have been discovered in a collection that somebody had in Turkey of ancient documents. And it still needs to be peer-reviewed, but it seems that the earliest fragment of Mark's Gospel, a first-century fragment of Mark's Gospel, has been found amongst that collection. So taken alongside the manuscript evidence, this simple study, which was only known to academics from 2001, shows us that the Gospel writers get such incidental details as what people were called right. Now, this is even more extraordinary when you make a comparison with what people were called in a neighbouring country. So a study was then done into male Jewish names, not in Palestine in the first century, but in Egypt in the first century. So still within the Jewish community, and only really a few miles away geographically, what were people called? Well, the most common names in the Jewish inscriptions from Greco-Roman Egypt were, number one, Lazarus, two, Sabbateus, three, Joseph, four, Dositheus, five, Pappus, six, Ptolemaeus, and seven, Samuel. These are not the same, even just a few miles away. And yet, the gospel writers, writing hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles away, get the names of who actually lived in Palestine right. They get that detail right. This couldn't be a hoax, since the study was only done in 2003. Now, that's just one small insight. There are plenty of other insights I could give you as to why we should take the New Testament seriously as history and not just write it off as myth and legend. We could look at some of the manuscript evidence, the numerical evidence, and all of that. We're not going to do that tonight. If you want to ask more questions, you could. So I want to suggest to you that based on the evidence from the texts themselves, it's highly speculative, highly difficult to argue that Jesus was a myth or a legend. I would also go on to say that Jesus doesn't fit into the category of literary fiction. If he did, what we read in the Gospels is inexplicable. It would have required exceptional genius to invent the character of Jesus and put into his mouth the kind of parables that are in themselves literary masterpieces and, of course, have entered into Western culture in an extraordinary way. It's not really credible that four individual gospel writers with very little formal education between them would simultaneously come up with such literary genius. In fact, the more we know about the leading cultures of the time, the more we see that if the person of Jesus reported for us in the Gospels was not a historic reality, it would have been an uphill battle inventing him, because he doesn't fit the stereotypes of the culture. The Jesus of the Gospels isn't anyone's hero, Greek, Roman, or Jew. They all find him a challenge to their ideals. The Jewish ideal, of course, was for a strong military leader who was going to fulfill their idea of what the messianic prophecies had been and fight the Roman army. And Jesus doesn't do that. He resists that model, that stereotype. The Greek ideal favoured the kind of Epicurean avoidance of extremes of pain and pleasure that would disturb people's peace. And others preferred Stoicism, the suppression of emotion. Jesus was utterly different. In such intense agony as he faced in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, we read, sweated drops of blood. He asks God, he's in this struggle about whether he's going to face the cross. A Greek could not have invented that kind of perception. One atheist writer in the British press, one of our sort of leading atheist journalists, a guy called Matthew Paris, suggests in the Spectator magazine recently that if Jesus hadn't existed, not even the church would have invented him. He just doesn't fit in. So what we read about Christ as we encounter him in these texts is astounding. And I want to suggest to you tonight that neither he nor his claims can be reasonably dismissed as myth or legend. His existence is attested to by historical sources. And his claims to be divine, his claims to be the way for us to be able to know God, are there in the earliest and contemporaneous accounts of his life. We need to be careful before discounting this as legend. So if Jesus and his claim to be the Christ, his claim to be God with us, is not legend, what should we conclude about him? If he was not a myth and he did live in history, I want us to spend some time just examining what he did actually say about himself. Now, obviously, the New Testament is huge, and we have a limited time here tonight. So I've chosen some of the statements, some of the claims that Jesus made about himself from John's Gospel to give you a chance to dig into and respond to what he said about himself. And the first statement comes in John chapter 6, verse 35, where Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life." The British writer Bernard Levin wrote this about the West. He said, "Countries like ours are full of people who have all the material comforts they desire, together with such non-material blessings as a happy family, and yet lead lives of quiet and at times noisy desperation, understanding nothing but the fact that there's a hole inside them. And however much food and drink they pour into it, however many motor cars and television sets they stuff it with, and however many well-balanced children and loyal friends they parade around the edges of it, it aches." Western society is geared around wanting us, making us want more and more stuff. That phrase inbuilt obsolescence, popularized in the 1950s, meant instilling in the buyer the desire to own something a little newer, a little better, a little sooner than is necessary. Jesus said, "I am the bread of life." For hundreds of years, people have tried to satisfy that hunger with material things. Yet statistics show us that affluent countries have not got happier as they've grown richer. One scholar writes, "The science of happiness offers two explanations for the paradox. Capitalism, it notes, is adept at turning luxuries into necessities, bringing to the masses what elites have always enjoyed. But the flip side of this genius is that people come to take for granted the things they once coveted from afar. Frills they thought they could never have are now essentials they cannot do without. People are stuck on a treadmill. As they achieve a better standard of living, they become inured to its pleasures." In the face of this question, that ache, that hole in every human soul, Jesus Christ says, "I am the bread of life." This is an extraordinary claim. He claims that whoever comes to him will never go hungry, and whoever believes in him will never be thirsty. In other words, he is claiming that relationship with him is totally sufficient to satisfy the deepest hunger of the human heart. Wow, that's a pretty staggering claim. Jesus claimed this across cultures. He said, "Whoever comes to me, I'll never drive away." That this is a universal claim being made. I suggest to you tonight that the way to test that claim is to try and see whether it's true. 3 weeks ago, I was speaking at Cambridge University at a church where many Cambridge University students came to came to listen to a talk. And the night before, my husband was at home, and a very good friend of ours who's the same age as us, well, a couple of years older than us. I'm 37, by the way, so ancient compared to all of you. A very good friend of ours is a banker, and He has made a great success of his life. You know, he's made his first 100 million, and he realized, I'm now chasing my second 100 million. What is my life really about? Do I want to spend the next 5 years chasing more and more money? So that Saturday night, he came over to our house, and he'd been doing some investigating about the person of Jesus. Had not grown up at all in a religious family, hadn't really considered the possibility of God. He'd done some research into some of the reasons why God might exist. We looked at some of those at lunchtime today. He'd done some investigation into the historical verification of the accounts of Jesus' life. But that Saturday night, he made a decision. He made a decision that he was going to invite Jesus into his life. And with tears at our kitchen table, he encountered the person of Jesus. And it's transformed him. It's an extraordinary encounter. That's what Jesus is claiming here. He says, I am the bread of life. It's a radical, audacious, bold, and if it's untrue, it's extraordinarily, ridiculously arrogant claim to make. That in relationship with this person, the deepest hunger of every human heart could be satisfied. But I suggest to you it's a testable claim. St. Augustine wrote this. Man, this part of thy creation desires to praise thee. Thou movest us to delight in praising thee. You have formed us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. Jesus answers that question, that search for meaning and purpose, by claiming that he himself is the one who can satisfy. Then secondly, Jesus goes on in John's gospel to make another claim. The second claim he makes that I want us to look at, don't worry, we're not going to look at all of them. The second one is, I am the light of the world. I am the light of the world. I want to suggest to you tonight that whatever worldview you believe in, whatever your belief system, your operating system that you base your life on, whatever it is, the one thing it must be able to deal with is the reality of pain, the reality of darkness in the world. My colleague Christian Hofreiter is going to be giving a talk on this on Thursday night, exploring the Christian answer to the question of suffering. But here Jesus makes an extraordinary claim. He says, I am the light of the world. What do you really think about the darkness and the pain, the suffering, the evil in the world around you? And does the path you're following, does the worldview you're pursuing actually adequately deal with that question? I mentioned earlier today that for 7 years I lived in a place called Peckham. It's a community in London where my husband and I moved together to be part of a Christian community there and to be involved in leading a Christian community there. It's the most notorious place in Britain for guns and gangs. People were murdered on our street on a very regular basis. And we lived in the midst of the violence and darkness that is possible in this world. In our community, we welcomed people who'd experienced everything personally, from child prostitution. One girl had been sold by her father into a paedophile ring and had been abused for years by her father and his friends. To domestic violence, women who'd been beaten by husbands and partners, to drug dealers, to young gang members who, when they wanted to leave their gang, were threatened by the leaders of that gang that unless they stole money from the church, their mother would be raped. That's the sort of darkness we were seeing on a weekly basis. My dear friend experienced the loss of her son. Her son was cut down in the street. He was stabbed. He was murdered in a gang incident. Darkness is real. You know, what we're doing here tonight is not abstract. It's not philosophizing about nice ideas. Jesus Christ claimed to be the light of the world, to be the one who could deal with the darkness of the world. And this is both an intellectual proposition. It's important that it's true, but it's also a lived reality, and it's something that's testable. Darkness is not just something out there that we observe, though, if we're honest. It's also something within every human heart, within all of us. And we can try to deny the reality of that. Perhaps it makes us uncomfortable to face up to our own shortcomings. I heard the story of I was traveling to the States and heard the story on the plane of a priest who was working in New York City. And he wanted to repair his church. It was in some disrepair. And he was working in a community where the mafia held sway. And a mafia chieftain came to the priest after his brother had been killed. The mafia guy's brother had been killed. And he wanted the priest to give his brother a Christian funeral, to give him a burial. And the priest was fine with that. But as they were just talking about the details of the service, the mafia guy said to the priest, "Listen, if you say at my brother's funeral that he was a saint, I will pay for all the repairs on the church. But if you don't, I'm going to make your life very difficult." Now, you know, this was a moral dilemma for the priest. He didn't know what to do. He was nervous. The day of the funeral came. Everybody was standing around the grave. The dark glasses were on. The time came for the coffin to go into the ground. And it was the moment, really, for the priest to say some words about the man who died. And he pointed into the coffin and he said, "Every one of us here knows this man. We all knew him, and we knew that he was a liar, a murderer, an adulterer, and a cheat." There was an intake of breath. The priest looked up, pointed to the man's brother, and said, "Compared to his brother, he was a saint." We like to think about darkness as something out there. You know, we think about the problems in the world. But what about every one of us? If we're honest, we know that we've hurt others. We know that we've not lived perfectly. We know the selfishness of our own hearts. The brilliant writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn put it like this: "If only there were evil people insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But," he wrote, "the line separating good and evil passes not through states nor political parties nor classes, but through every human heart." Darkness and sadness, injustice and violence are real. And Jesus does not pretend that they're not. But he does say, "I am the light of the world. I am the light of the world." He enters into our dark world. And actually, at his death, at his crucifixion, the claim is that he takes into himself the moral filth, the darkness of humankind into himself, and deals with that at the cross, making forgiveness, making purity, making cleansing, making a new fresh start possible for those who will receive that forgiveness. A cartoon has been found on a wall in the ruins of ancient Rome showing how that Christian message of the crucifixion of Jesus was viewed by some who first heard it. The cartoon is a caricature of Jesus' crucifixion. It shows a man's body hanging on a cross, but the body has the head of a donkey. And then there's a figure of a young man with his hand raised as if to worship this grotesque image. And underneath is the inscription, "He worships his God!" Exclamation mark. The crucifixion of Jesus confounds people's expectations and categories. And the cross is so familiar in the West to us that we barely think about it. But have you ever wondered, have you ever considered how strange it is that people wear a symbol of execution around their neck, that they put it on buildings. It would be strange, wouldn't it, to meet someone who had a necklace with a hangman's noose or an electric chair dangling around their neck, perhaps in their earrings, lovely earrings, you know, of a gun, a method of execution. And yet it is not strange to see a cross. Why? Because the cross is that symbol of how Jesus, the light of the world, overcame the darkness of the world. No other death is anything like this. In his death, Jesus defeats darkness. We'll skip over one of those and come into land. The next I am statement that Jesus makes, I'm just going to look at two more and then we'll open things up for questions. Jesus, remember, has claimed that he's the light of the world and that he's the bread of life. Then he makes another staggering claim in John's Gospel, chapter 14. He says this, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life." As human beings, we all wonder what happens after death. Is there life? Is there consciousness? Is there accountability for how we've lived? I suggest to you today that the person to trust on a question like this is the one who has experienced death, Jesus Christ. He claims that he is the way to God, the one who is capable of bringing us, human beings, into eternal life. It makes us uncomfortable to consider this. Woody Allen, who I love, says, "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." You know, we all identify with that. But Jesus confronts directly that question that all of us face at some point. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He's conquered the power of death. We can experience and know that reality in our own lives, or so he claims. Now, the truth can be both uncomfortable and liberating, like someone switching a light on. Often people think God shouldn't be thought about in those kinds of categories of truth and reality. You know, either we like the idea or we don't like it. And if we like religion, then, you know, we pursue it, we like it, but we don't like it. It doesn't matter. I want to challenge that a little bit for us today and suggest to you that it doesn't actually matter whether we like it or not. It doesn't really matter what our preferences are. The important question is there a God? Is God actually there? And is any of this Jesus stuff true and real? And if it is, then I need to make a response to that. And if it isn't, I can happily walk away and stop thinking about it. So it's not a leap of faith, as sometimes people say, you know, just a leap into the dark. Jesus is claiming, "I'm the truth. I'm the truth." So if you put your trust in me, you're trusting a person who actually exists, who's real, about whom there's evidence that's substantial, that's going to be able to hold your weight. Truth is located in him. Again, a staggering claim to be made by just an ordinary person. "Through him we find a path to life which lasts beyond the grave," or so Jesus claims. If this is the case, that Jesus is God with us, it's an extraordinary possibility. And if that is true, it's a truth worth staking our lives on. It was mentioned earlier that I had the opportunity to meet the Taliban. And this was something that happened a few years ago in 1996. It was before September the 11th, when the Taliban had taken over three quarters of Afghanistan. I didn't yet have the whole country. And a small group of us were intrigued. We were theologians, so we were actually intrigued by the Taliban's Islamic theology. We were interested in their ideas. But as Christians, we were also concerned that they hear an alternative, and they have the opportunity to consider an alternative. So we were able to get journalist visas, and by an amazing set of circumstances, three of us were invited into their military headquarters. And we interviewed the education minister, the foreign minister, and the religion minister, the keeper of the Holy Quran. At the end of that interview, it was a number of hours. They were all armed with Kalashnikovs, and we were Oxford students, you know, earnestly there in our open-toed sandals. And we got our Bibles out in their language, and we handed them over, saying and thinking, this is the most precious gift we think one person can give another person. Keeper of the Holy Quran took hold of the Bible and he said, I know exactly what this book is. I've prayed for years that I could read this book. I will read it every day until I finish it. The question of truth is an intellectual question. It's also a personal question. And I challenge you to consider this statement of Jesus. He says, I am the truth. Wow, what an astonishingly arrogant claim, if not true. But if it's true, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It's worthwhile taking a step towards Jesus and testing whether this is in fact real, I suggest to you. And then finally, the question of life after death. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He claims to embody and encapsulate life itself. He claims that he is the author and director of life. So for the person who believes in Jesus, physical death is not the tragic end. It's the gateway to eternal life and fellowship with God. Jesus claimed that he had authority of death, and then Christians believe that he demonstrated that by rising from the dead in history. And that again is something you can scrutinize, you can question, you can test. Frank Morrison was a lawyer who determined to disprove the resurrection of Jesus and to once and for all undermine Christianity. The result of his investigation was his conversion to Christ and the publication of his book, Who Moved the Stone? A book which, although it's old now, really looks at the overwhelming evidence for the resurrection. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. So in conclusion, I hope that you will consider some of the evidence and look at and consider the kind of academic research that helps us today really begin to settle that question of whether Jesus was a legend, whether he was a myth, whether the divine claims and miracles were legendary accumulation or not. But also to realise that Jesus makes these amazing claims, to be the bread of life, to satisfy that question of meaning, to be the light of the world, to deal with that question of darkness, to be the way, the truth, and the life, to enter into that question of truth and reality, and to be the resurrection of, and the life, to answer that question about life after death. Jesus says in John 14, because I live, you also shall live. Now, of course, I haven't touched on so many things. One of them is even that formulation in the Greek, ego eimi, I am, is in itself a claim that Jewish people understood, because I am was the name of God in the Old Testament. So we've seen some of the evidence that the sources about him are historically viable or valuable rather than myth. We've seen that the man who lived in history did make these astonishing claims to be God with us and to be humanity's hope. I suggest to you tonight that a man who makes such claims could be delusional or he could be malevolent. But are you prepared to consider the possibility that he could be the truth? Man, myth, or reality, it's really open to you to discover for yourself and to make a decision for yourself. But often the context for this discovery within a Christian context is the context of relationship. And it may be that there are some people here who would like to take a tentative first step. the philosopher Blaise Pascal called it a wager, and talked about taking that step to see if God is actually real, to pray the atheist prayer, God, if you're there, reveal yourself to me, a dangerous prayer to pray. So before we open things up for Q&A, we're going to have a moment of silence, just a time to consider, to think about how we personally react, respond to what we've heard tonight. And then I'm going to pray a short prayer, a very short prayer. And there's no pressure at all. If you want to, you can totally ignore this bit and think about something else. Think about sports or whatever it is you want to think about and ignore what I'm saying. But for those who want to, there's an opportunity, a very short moment, an opportunity to take that tentative step. So we're just going to close our eyes for a moment. And if you'd like to pray, maybe for the first time or for the first time in a long time, when I say this short prayer, why don't you just echo it in your heart? So just have a moment of silence. And then I'm going to pray. God, if you're there, I'd like to make a tentative step towards you. I'd like to test out, to check out whether those statements Jesus made are true. Please, will you show yourself to me if you're real. I recognize I'm not perfect. I need forgiveness. If you're there, will you come into my life and show yourself to me? Will you give me that forgiveness you offer and that new start? Amen. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to have some time for questions now, I think. We're going to take them in threes. So take three questions, we'll write them down, and I'll try and answer them, give a response, and then take three more. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Amy.